Here's the Buddha himself addressing one of his senior disciples, his foremost disciples, Shariputra, this very Dharmakaya, that is, this mind of the Buddha, or this ultimate reality, this ultimate consciousness. This very Dharmakaya is called the realm of beings when it is concealed by a sheath of boundless afflictions. That is, the Buddha mind, this divine mind, is called the realm of beings. It's encapsulated or embodied in human beings when it's concealed by a sheath of boundless afflictions. It actually manifests as a human being. These beings wandering repeatedly through births and deaths in beginningless samsara, the cycle of existence buffeted by the waves of samsara. Shariputra, this very Dharmakaya, or mind of the Buddha, is called the Tathagata, the Buddha, the Arhat, a liberated one, Samyaksam Buddha, a perfectly enlightened, perfectly awakened being, when it has become free from the veils of all the afflictions, has passed beyond all sufferings. So what he's referring to here is the Buddha nature that lies within every sentient being, this Buddha nature, this utter pristine dimension of our own awareness, always present, and identical to Dharmakaya, the mind of a Buddha, but veiled as long as we are still ordinary sentient beings or identify ourselves as such. Whereas when these veils are removed, then we realize that which has always been there, realize our very identity, the very nature of our minds as Dharmakaya. I think there's a certain similarity there with Nicholas of Cusa. Now, that which motivates individuals onto a spiritual path to make sacrifices, to devote themselves with all their hearts and minds and souls to the practice, whether as Christians or, to use the Buddha's metaphor, applying oneself to the practice as if with all the intensity, as if one's hair were on fire. What arouses such a type, what's a sense of renunciation, what is the nature of such renunciation? I'll focus here on a few of the great contemplatives from the Greek Orthodox traditions, most if not all of these that I'll cite, clustered around Mount Athos, so this great contemplative center in Greece. So St. Simeon from the 11th century, he comments, what is the nature of this renunciation? He says, first of all, seek three things to set out on the path and totally devote oneself to a path to perfection. He said, free yourself of all anxiety regarding both real and imaginary things. So set your mind at ease. Disengage your mind from fixations, addictions, cravings, and so forth that are bound to give rise to anxiety. Release that all. Strive for a pure conscience with no lingering sense of self-reproach. So monitor and purify your conduct so you have nothing to regret. And finally, be completely detached so that your thoughts are not drawn to anything worldly, not even to your own body. So really seek transcendence rather than identifying with a body, grasping onto mundane things as a source of happiness. And in Buddhist tradition, he sums up his whole path in this one line: do not engage in any vices whatsoever. In other words, strive as diligently as we can to avoid any type of unwholesome conduct. Devote yourself to a bounty of virtue. Completely subdue your mind, your own mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Again, appears to be some profound commonality there. Now, when we set out with the spirit of renunciation, establishing a foundation of ethics on a contemplative path, then we recognize, and Christian contemplatives have identified this for centuries, and Buddhist and Hindu and Sufi have recognized that the mind that we bring to contemplative practice is, to a certain extent, varying extents, dysfunctional. It doesn't work very well, and especially in terms of attention, the mind tends to just be a pretty crude instrument because it's so hard to focus in a continuous fashion. St. Gregory Palamas, again, one of these great Greek Orthodox contemplatives, from this golden era, 9th century, 10th century through the 14th century, one after another, these extraordinary beings who had spent 20 years in contemplative solitude, just probing the depths of their own path. He writes, since the intellect of those recently embarked on the spiritual path constantly darts away, again, as soon as it has been concentrated, so he's referring to excitation, or what we call agitation or distraction, they must continually bring it back once more. So keep on returning, restraining, calling back this wandering attention. For in their inexperience, they are unaware that of all things, it is the most difficult to observe and the most mobile. So this mind itself, the intellect itself, the most difficult thing to observe, all of our senses are so habituated to looking outwards in our pursuit of happiness, in our pursuit of security, safety. We're so oriented outwards. This is not simply an innovation of the 20th century with materialism and all of that, or the advent of science. This goes way, way back, that generally we're oriented outwards for seeking happiness, seeking freedom of suffering. It takes some real cultivation. It takes training. It takes effort to learn how to observe the mind itself. And again, the awareness with which we try to observe the mind, to probe inwardly, is most mobile. That is, it's fluctuating, it's fleeting, it's agitated and excited, very difficult to get it to calm down. But now as a strategy, he says, that is why some teachers recommend them to pay attention to the exhalation and the inhalation of their breath, and to restrain it a little so that while they are watching it, the intellect too may be held in check. Very simple pranayama technique. I've seen this in Iyengar's teachings on pranayama. It's a very, very common technique. You breathe in, perhaps just a little bit deeper than you would, hold it just a tad, and then release. And that just very gentle modification of the breath, it immediately tends to calm the mind. And this discursive mind, this agitated mind, tends to settle down a little bit. Straight pranayama in mainstream Christian practice. Every single person I'll cite here is mainstream, cited as an authority by their own tradition, which I think is very important. And likewise for the Buddhist tradition, I'm not getting any fringe people here. So, calming the mind in Christianity. They recognize the problem. I think we're pretty aware this is a recognized problem in Buddhism as well. So here's one of many, many citations. Buddha again, addressing Shariputra, one of his senior disciples. Shariputra, take the analogy of a potter or a potter's apprentice spinning the potter's wheel. If he makes a long revolution, he knows it is long. If he makes a short revolution, he knows it is short. Shariputra, similarly, a bodhisattva, a great being, mindfully breathes in and mindfully breathes out. If the inhalation is long, he knows the inhalation is long. If the exhalation is long, he knows the exhalation is long. And there's a phase here, or a sequence, and that is when we first sit down to mindfully attend to the breathing. Probably we're coming from a relatively agitated state. We've been thinking a lot or actively moving about or talking. And so we sit down, it's a little bit like, whew. So the breathing tends to be a bit more exaggerated, tends to be a bit longer just as we're kind of catching our breath, so to speak. But as we settle down for 5 minutes, 10, 15 minutes, or 2 or 3 months of practicing every day, then the inhalation, exhalation tends to then subside. The sheer volume of air taken in and out decreases. The whole system, the nervous system calms, the mind calms. This body-mind interaction subdues the mind. So he says, first of all, long. Then if the inhalation is short, he knows the inhalation is short. If the exhalation is short, he knows the exhalation is short. So this implies that the mind, the attention, is following the full course of the breath in and out, and only in that way can you really recall or note its duration. If you're just pecking at it once in a while, you won't really know how long the breath is taking place. But if you're with it through the whole course of the in-breath, the out-breath, then you recognize its relative shortness or longness. Shariputra, thus a bodhisattva, a great being, by dwelling with introspection and with mindfulness, eliminates avarice and disappointment towards the world by means of non-objectification. This is worth a couple of minutes. In Buddhist practice, which is where I've seen some of the most sophisticated presentations of ways of training the attention, which I spoke about last December in the Shamatha project we held last year, does unpack different faculties of the mind that are crucial or instrumental for training the attention. And mindfulness is one. And in mindfulness in this context is being able to maintain an ongoing flow of sustained attention without forgetfulness on whatever one wishes to attend to. So it's an ongoing composure, a collectedness, a mindfulness as opposed to a mindlessness or a forgetfulness. So in this case, one is mindful of the breathing, attending to the sensations of the breath, but there's also another faculty of introspection by means of which we monitor the meditative process so we quickly detect whether the mind has gotten derailed, has gone into distraction, agitation, daydreaming, wandering, or whether it's just kind of imploding into laxity, dullness, lethargy, and maybe falling asleep. So these are the two great faculties by means of which the attention can be trained, the mind can be calmed. So by dwelling with introspection and with mindfulness, this eliminates avarice. And avarice is this outward-looking craving, feeling somehow that if only I could have that, that person, that job, that money, that house, that something, that then I would find the happiness that I seek. And it may be something belonging to somebody else, as in the case of avarice. But this is eliminates avarice because through this practice, the Buddha actually referred to this on another occasion, saying that this mindfulness of breathing, when developed and cultivated, leads to a sublime state, an ambrosial dwelling, in which unwholesome states subside immediately. So what he's pointing out here, and this has been borne out by generations, 100 generations of meditators since the time of the Buddha, is that by simply calming the mind, mindfully bringing greater stability, vividness to the attention, a sense of well-being arises from the very nature of awareness, even without attending to anything pleasant, even without looking for some pleasant stimulus that's coming to you. It's the very quality of your awareness that is giving rise to a sense of well-being. And the more you discover a sense of well-being that arises from within, then naturally, the less there would be avarice of fixating on things outside to give us happiness. If you've already got it from inside, then what do you need the outside for? And so this practice eliminates avarice and disappointment, and that is we launch out into the world with avarice, and then we're bound to meet with obstacles that prevent the fulfillment of our desires. This gives rise to disappointment. So this eliminates avarice and disappointment toward the world by means of non-objectification. This can be understood in different ways, but non-objectification in the sense of overcoming the delusion of thinking there's something out there, and if I'm clever enough, if I have a good enough strategy, I'll find that out there, that thing, that person, that something out there that's going to deliver the goods and make me happy. And once I find it, however much I have to struggle, maybe it's riches, maybe it's the greatest life insurance policy ever got, I don't know, living in Santa Barbara might do it for some people, but once I've got it, I'm going to hold on tenaciously. That is objectification, superimposing, projecting, transferring the origins of one's happiness out into the world. Often this happens by superimposing this on another person and feeling, if you're not in my life, if you are not with me, there's no possibility of my happiness. And that's a setup for disappointment towards the world. So a simple practice, and it is really, I would say, breathtakingly simple, but it's not breathtakingly, it's breathgivingly simple, practice of mindfulness of breathing can yield very big dividends. And we see this quite independently. As far as I know, this St. Gregory of Palamas, I've not seen any evidence that would suggest that he was actually tapping into the Buddhist tradition. I mean, he's living in Greece. They didn't have a whole lot of communication back and forth between India or Tibet at that time in Greece. So it looks like this was an independent method, an independent laboratory of contemplatives living in their caves, their little huts and so forth on Mount Athos. Similar aims, wanting to calm the mind out of a spirit of renunciation, seeking perfection, seeking liberation, and then actually coming across very, very similar methods, suggest there may be something universal going on here, even when the strategies or the methods themselves bear a great deal in common.